Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. She's the most popular female superhero in the world, with an invisible jet, a lasso of truth, not to mention a great pair of legs. But the story behind the creation of Wonder Woman is even more fascinating than the character herself. She sprung from the mind of a pioneering psychologist who invented the lie detector test, lived in a house with two mistresses and his wife, and had a taste for bondage, group sex parties, and radical feminism. What a story. And my guest tells it all in her new book. Jill Lepore is a writer for The New Yorker, professor at Harvard, and author of The Secret History of Wonder Woman. And welcome back to Radio Boston, Jill Lepore. It's great to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And I want to invite our listeners into this conversation. What's your take on Wonder Woman? Did you learn lessons about life or feminism from reading her comics? What's the legacy of this comic book superhero? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So I would love to ask you, first of all, just to describe Wonder Woman to people who are listening who maybe weren't Wonder Woman fans and never had an opportunity to read a Wonder Woman comic. What could she do? What were her superhero powers?
Sure, yeah. I just kind of want to backtrack a little bit just to say I think your intro is a little over the top. I didn't write about group sex parties or taste for bondage.
Sorry.
So I don't want to oversell the kinkiness of the book or misrepresent the lives of people who, you know, have families. So Wonder Woman was created in 1941. She's the longest-lasting female comic book superhero. She comes from a land of Amazons, of a land of women warriors in Paradise Island, and she has a set of superpowers that are kind of the analog of the kinds of things that Superman can do. She has bracelets that can stop bullets. She has a magic lasso. Anyone she ropes has to tell the truth. And as you say, she has this cool invisible jet that she flies around.
Were you a big Wonder Woman fan?
No, not in the least, I'm sorry to say. I was far too kind of geeky and kind of brainy of a kid reading books, serious books as a kid. I was a really serious kid. I wouldn't have ever read comic books. Nor have I really paid much attention to Wonder Woman as an adult. My kids are real comic books people because we live in a different moment of comic and superhero culture. There's a sort of saturation, certainly at the kind of blockbuster film level with superheroes in our culture. So it's hard, you know, raising kids not to encounter these things all the time.
Sure.
But my interest in the subject actually was really inadvertent. I'm a political historian, and I kind of stumbled onto a series of really interesting discoveries about Wonder Woman that led me to feel like, wow, she's kind of, you know, interesting in the history of comics, but she's way more interesting in the history of American politics.
No question at all. So you draw this fascinating portrait of William Moulton Marston, who created Wonder Woman, and he's... It's just so interesting. I mean, his life story is so fascinating, and there's so many contradictions in it. He invented the lie detector test. He was an academic who wrote comic books, an admirer of feminism. Let's start with this. The way he lived in his life was really interesting. He lived with his wife. He lived with his mistress. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Marston is really interesting, and he writes in the 40s, when he's writing Wonder Woman, that Wonder Woman is essentially and fundamentally a work of scholarship, which is kind of fascinating when you think about it. But he was a psychologist. He had a PhD from Harvard. He also had a law degree from Harvard. He'd been a Harvard undergraduate. He'd fallen in love with his childhood sweetheart. He grew up in Saugus, in a neighborhood called Cliftondale, went to Malden High School. And so he's a real New Englander. His girlfriend went off to Holyoke. He went off to Harvard. They fell in love. They got married in 1915, right after they graduated. But she was one of the first of the new women, the generation of women who first go to college. And they were both really wrapped up in the suffrage and early feminist movements of the 1910s. The word feminism doesn't exist before about 1913. And then it's kind of everywhere. And Marston, as a psychologist, was fascinated by this. His wife was an incredibly intellectually ambitious woman. She went to Boston University Law School when he went to Harvard Law School because Harvard didn't admit women. She got a master's degree at Radcliffe because Harvard didn't admit women to graduate programs. And they set off on their lives together and confronted the dilemma that all new women faced in the 1920s, which was she wanted to both work and have a career. Marston, meanwhile, had developed a fascination with emotions. That was his scientific work was about emotions. And that's how he came to work on the lie detector, the detection of deception. But he came to be really interested in sort of excitement, how to measure excitement of people he was testing at the Harvard Psychological Laboratory. And wrapped up in a whole bunch of writing that we as historians associate with the sex radicalism of the 19 teens and 20s, the bohemianism. And so it's in this environment that Marston's teaching at Tufts in 1925 when he falls in love with one of his students, a senior named Olive Byrne, and decides that he needs more than one woman. He gives his wife this choice. He could either run off with his mistress or she could live with them. And his wife kind of thinks about it. She's like, well, if she were to stay home and take care of the children, I wouldn't mind if you left the mistress. They kind of make this deal, which is really strange and interesting at the kind of biographical level. It's completely fascinating, the family story and the drama of that, because mm-hmm. they then have four children together. Each woman has two children. And
but I love this idea that she says, yeah, if she'll stay home and take care of the children, because in a way we're dealing with a set of issues that we're still dealing with today. That's what one of the things that's so fascinating about this.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really kind of discouraging and disheartening for me reading magazine stories from the 1920s. They're all kind of, can a woman have it all? Can you work and also be a mother?
Right.
And you can pick up any magazine today, go down to the newsstand, you know, surf the web, and you'll find exactly the same article. There's really been very little structural. I mean, for all the incredible work, hard work, and political change, there's really not been a great structural solution to that. So their family solution is bizarre, but it actually emerges from, you know, an ongoing problem, which makes it so interesting to me.
It really interesting. So there's Marston, his wife, his mistress, and for a while there's another mistress, right?
There's this woman, Marjorie Wilkes Huntley, and people in the family have different ideas about what her relationship was, romantically or whatever, with anybody else in the family. She was certainly set apart, and she did not have any children with Marston. She had had a hysterectomy. She was a librarian. She often worked here in Boston, and she had belonged with Marston's and his wife and his mistress to a kind of salon that met in Boston in the 1920s at Marston's aunt's house, Carolyn Marston Keatley. And I found in the archives the minutes of this meeting. It met every week or a couple times a week. And it really is a sort of cult of female sexual power. And it kind of draws on all this kind of pop psychology from the 1920s and also on a lot of mysticism and ideas about psychic force, and then also draws on the writings of Margaret Sanger, who was the aunt of Olive Byrne, who is one of the women involved in this family. And that was the thing that got me so fascinated about this project and why I felt like I need to write a book about Wonder Woman, because I hadn't understood it all, and it was kept a family secret because Marston's relationship with Olive Byrne was a family secret, and that the children were his was a family secret, that even the children didn't know that he was their father. Wonder Woman's relationship to Olive Byrne had been to Margaret Sanger had been lost to history.
It's fascinating. And of course, I'm going to get to Wonder Woman, but this, I want to stick with Marston because he's just such an interesting character. I mean, he's got some really unconventional views about a lot, obviously, and he writes this book called Emotions of Normal People, and this sort of destroys his academic career, right? But in it, he writes about his views on love and submission between a man and a woman. What did he believe, and what do we learn about his views that might explain this unusual situation with his wife and the other women he lived with?
So is this sort of funny about Marston? Like, when you read if you were to read a lot of pop psychology or even scholarly psychology, and this is sort of a hybrid from the 1920s, a lot of it would sound just as kooky as this. I mean, like, think about, you know, the writings of Carl Jung or even Freud. If Freud had been a dead end and you were to go back and pull out Freud and read, like, the case study of Dora about, like, this young girl, of course she really wants to have sex with her father, and that's why she, you know, is ill all the time, you'd be like, what are they talking about? Marston is kind of just like that. He's actually not that much weirder than, in some ways less weird than Freud and Jung. It's just that they were generative, right? People followed in their tracks and they have whole bodies of work that develop around them. Marston had a theory of emotions in which there were four emotions. It's like dominance, compliance, captivation, submission. I can never remember all four. Although actually there's an acronym DISC that is all for. It's domination, inducement, compliance. And the reason it's an acronym is because it's actually a management consulting theory that's actually apparently widely adopted, which I think is hilarious. but he believed that our emotions are neuronal, that they inhere in our neurons, and we sort of must just submit to them. And then one piece of that emotional life is our sexual experience and our sexual longing and our sexual pleasure. And he, therefore, was essentially arguing against abnormal psychology. Sort of this book, Emotions of Normal normal people. It's like, oh, your emotions are normal because they're neuronal. There's no abnormal emotions. And so with regard to sexual practices and romantic associations, you're like, you should learn to love the love parts of yourself, he would say. So he really was kind of embracing nonconformism, sex radicalism, a kind of tolerance for different family and sexual and romantic arrangements that did cost him his career, both because of his work as a scientist, but more because of his own family arrangements.
So that's Marston. So I want to ask you about how he came to create Wonder Woman, because he's essentially blacklisted from academia because of his unusual family arrangements. He ends up getting drawn into the world of comic books. But this idea that what the world really needed was a female superhero. We had Superman, we had Batman and Robin. Why did he believe we needed a female superhero?
So after he's blacklisted from academia in 1928, he goes to Hollywood. He works in Hollywood for a while. Then he comes back and is living in New York in the 30s and doing all kinds of things as a consulting psychologist. Olive Byrne becomes a staff writer for Family Circle magazine. And after comic books start in the 1930s, they become controversial. Superman starts in 1938, Batman 1939. And by 1940, there are calls to ban and burn comics all over the United States. So a major comic books publisher, this guy M.C. Gaines, who publishes All-American Comics, calls in Marston as a consultant after he reads an article that Olive Byrne writes in Family Circle about how William Moulton Marston believes that comics are actually good for children. And Marston says, here's what you need to do to avoid controversy. You need a female superhero because the critics are all complaining about the violence in the comic books, and that's a part of their blood-curdling masculinity, he says. But if you had a female superhero, you'd quiet all of your critics.
Interesting. All right. So then he designs, or he sort of imagines this female superhero, and she's got these wonderful powers that we've talked about, but she's modeled on the Varga girls.
Yes.
Right?
Said,
so there's just so many fascinating contradictions in this story.
I love
how
you said she's leggy. There's this great graphic for this guy who does these graphics of comics that sort of measures Wonder Woman's legs in every incarnation of Wonder Woman. So she's very sexy and sultry, and she's really kinky. She's clearly a really fetishized character, too. And a chief artistic influence for her are these Varga girls, which are basically the centerfolds in Esquire magazine.
Right.
Esquire was Playboy before there was Playboy, and Marston was actually a writer for Esquire. That was very much his scene, the gentleman who would read Esquire magazine. And
for the articles.
For the articles, of course. If you try to read the Varga girls at the Esquire magazine copies that are housed at Widener Library at Harvard, you will find they're not there because they've all been sliced out with razors by the undergraduates.
I see.
You know, really for the art.
For the art,
right. Anthony.
Yes,
yeah.
I understand.
So she's got this very sexy, sultry thing, which, you know, the publisher's like, well, as long as we're going to have a woman, we're going to have her be a bombshell. You know, she's going to be a pinup girl. So she's a bundle of contradictions in much the way that, like, Beyonce is a bundle of contradictions.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of her power clearly is sexual power, but Marston would have not seen that as a contradiction. He would have said, and he certainly did said, because although he was brought in to write a comic book that would be not controversial, Wonder Woman's like the most controversial comic book ever written because she's tied up all the time and because of her costume. Like, she's banned by the National League for Decent Literature because she's not wearing enough clothes. So she's really appealing in that way to boys, but she also really is appealing to girls. And the feminist message of the early comics that Marston writes is really undeniable. She runs for president. She arranges boycotts so that women can fight for equal wages at department stores. She does kind of all this progressive era labor activism. She's a really interesting model. And of course, then she fights in the war and she keeps urging women to join the WACs and the WAVES.
Mm. I just love this mixture, though. Another thing that's just amazing. So the magic lasso, which makes men tell the truth, conceived of by Marston, who invented the lie detector test.
Yeah.
You can't make this stuff up. It's unbelievable.
No, and like that's sort of obvious when you know those two facts about him. You're like, that's what that is. But there's so much stuff in the comics, in Wonder Woman comics from 41 to 47, that is essentially autobiographical. Like, Wonder Woman's arch nemesis is this guy, Dr. Psycho, who's always locking her up in his psychological laboratory. Well, he's based on Marston's Harvard undergraduate advisor, Hugo Munsterberg, who had a psychological laboratory, and he used to do tests on women, which he would, you know, chain them to machines and test them and strap them to devices. So the whole comic is filled with scenes from Marston's own life.
You do write a lot about the bondage that Wonder Woman potentially finds herself in. There was a long paragraph here, which I'm not going to read, but at a certain point, well, I'll just read part of it. She's locked in an electric cage. Wonder Woman is chained, bound, gagged, lassoed, tied, fettered, and manacled. She's locked in an electric cage. She's winched into a straitjacket from head to toe. Her eyes and mouth are taped shut. She's roped and then coffined in a glass box, dropped in the ocean. She's locked in a bank vault. She's tied to railroad tracks. But of course she gets out. So it's like, so that's the sort of message of feminist empowerment. But then there's also this kind of, this bondage thing, which sort of seems at odds with that.
Yeah,
idea.
It absolutely goes two ways. There's no one way to read that. I mean, Marston said, she's an allegory for the emancipation of women, you know, that women had gained the right to vote and now they were beginning to run for office. And Wonder Woman has to be chained up or tied up in every episode so that she can break free and allegorically recapitulate the emancipation of women. And in some way, you can kind of take him at that, because that same iconography, women being chained up and tied up, was used by suffragists and by birth control activists and by feminists for decades. Mm. And Marston and the artist that writes, that draws Wonder Woman, Harry G. Peter, were enormously influenced by that iconography, and they're basically just recycling it. So there's no doubt that that's going on. On the other hand, people would write in to the publisher and say, like, it's this great letter from a GI who writes in and says, like, where I get these chains and these masks, because, you know, and the red boots, because, you know, this is very exciting. It's clearly, you know, just a source of arousal for him.
Yeah, he's not really getting the deeper message.
And Marston's like, that's fine. What's wrong with that? That's fine, because this is sort of his shtick about sexual expression. But the publisher, they have this woman editor at DC Comics then named Dorothy Rubichick, and she comes up with a list of menaces that Wonder Woman could face that would not involve her being tied up. And Marston writes back to the publisher, please thank Miss Rubichek for her list of menaces. You know, and he completely ignores it. He's so completely determined to have her tied up and chained up in every story.
But what's the sort of, I mean, I'd love to ask you, sir, about your sort of ultimate conclusion about what we're supposed to think about Marston. I mean, you know, he created this female superhero, a kind of feminist icon, but he lived at home with two women, which seemed sort of not so respectful of the feminist ideal. I mean, what do you think about that? How should we think about him and this?
Yeah, I guess he's really fascinating. There's no way to be conclusive about that. I think he's, you know, he's clearly a charlatan and a showman, and he's putting together a hodgepodge of whatever ideas he thinks can sell and will be most current. But he has a certain commitment to a set of ideas that I don't think are squarely feminist. They're a mix of other kinds of things and his own views. I think what's important about the story and about the history of Wonder Woman is understanding that the tie with Sanger, because what that helps us to see is that we often
and Sanger, of course, just for our listeners, of course, she is the founder of Planned Parenthood, right?
Yeah, she and her sister Ethel Byrne opened the first birth control clinic in the United States in 1960, and Ethel Byrne's Olive Byrne's mother. But, you know, we think about feminism as coming in waves, the first wave ending in 1920 with the 19th Amendment and the second wave starting in the 1960s. When we think about Wonder Woman in the 1940s as having been inspired by suffragists and birth control activists, and in fact directly inspired by Margaret Sanger, and then also going on to inspire women like Gloria Steinem and second wave feminists, then Wonder Woman is like the missing link in the history of feminism. And that is far more interesting to me as a historian than whether, you know, William Marston was or not. Does he get some kind of feminism badge or something?
It's really interesting. I'd like to, finally, how was she received at the time? Because at one point I read, you remind us that in the 1940s, Wonder Woman was actually banned, right?
Yeah, so this was really tough for the publisher, who would hope that she was going to save all of his problems with the critics. So what he did actually was bring in another expert, a psychiatrist, a woman named Loretta Bender from Bellevue Hospital. She also taught at NYU. She ran the children's ward. She was an expert on aggression. And he asked her to read Wonder Woman and answer the critics, to say, okay, so people would say the problem with Wonder Woman is she's too sexy and she's tied up all the time. That's bad for kids and especially bad for girls. And Loretta Bender, who was this, you know, very esteemed expert, read all the comics and joined the editorial advisory board and said, you know what, I think, you know, Marston's a kook and his theories are kind of junk. But that said, you know, the comic book is actually really interesting, and it's not damaging to kids. It's like Little Red Riding Hood. It has a folkloric quality, a fantasy quality, and it's an interesting place for boys and girls to work out how they think about these problems.
Well, it's such a fascinating story. I wish we had more time to talk about it. Jill Lepore is a writer for The New Yorker, a professor of American history at Harvard, and author of the new book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. You can find a lot more information at radioboston.org. And Jill Lepore, thank you so much for coming in to talk about this.
Yeah, thanks for having
really
me.
Really fun. Thank you. And stay with us. There's a lot more ahead. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman. Now the world is ready for you.